Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Environmental groups have filed a lawsuit challenging county supervisors' approval of the massive Otay Ranch housing development in Proctor Valley based on fire danger to residents and habitat loss for endangered species. In a precedent-setting case, a judge has ordered the county to rescind its approval of the Hoskins Ranch subdivision planned in Julian, finding that their approval violated state law protecting agricultural lands. We'll have details on both of these landmark cases on today's show. On Crime Beat, Lemon Grove Councilman David Arambula is asking the public's help to find an assailant who attacked his wife outside their home. A judge has ruled that Alvin Quarles, known as the bolder-than-most rapist, can be released over the objections of his victims. And a jury in a civil suit filed by the family of Alfred Olongo has found that an El Cajon police officer was justified in the fatal shooting of Olongo back in 2016. Our newsmaker interview today is with Corey Briggs, a candidate running for San Diego City Attorney. Briggs is a public interest lawyer with a long history of suing the city on behalf of taxpayers, environmentalists, and open government advocates. He'll be talking about actions he'll take if elected, as well as ethics issues involving incumbent City Attorney Mara Elliott, whom Briggs says has tried to weaken the Public Records Act, tip off a campaign donor about a child abuse investigation at the donor's organization, and push a political agenda that's cost taxpayers money by putting the city on the losing side of multiple lawsuits. Then on Destination East County, hear about festive events coming up, including the Ramona Country Fair, Julian's Star Fest, concerts, movies in the park, and more. La Mesa's City Council has voted to keep a farmer's market downtown, but with some changes. Hear more on today's show. County Parks has announced some closures during August, plus we'll have some hiking safety tips if you're planning on hitting the trails, and hear about new cabins for the disabled at Dos Picos Park in Ramona. We'll also have news about some new air power for the county to fight fires. And finally, on our arts and music segment, hear how a San Diego State graduate helped create a new way of making movies in Disney's newly released version of The Lion King. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Last week, San Diego County supervisors approved the controversial Otay Ranch Village 14 master planned community in Proctor Valley near Jamul, which passed by a 3-2 vote. Now, several environmental groups have filed a trio of lawsuits, hoping a judge will cast the deciding vote to block the project based on fire danger to residents and threats to wildlife. Plaintiffs are the Center for Biological Diversity, Endangered Habitat League, Sierra Club, California Chaparral Institute, Preserve Wild Santee, and California Native Plant Society. The group's press release calls the project a sprawl development that will pave over hundreds of acres of habitat for golden eagles and other imperiled wildlife and build new homes in one of California's most dangerously fire-prone areas. Supervisor Diane Jacob and Nathan Fletcher voted against the controversial development, which would build approximately 1,100 new homes and 10,000 square feet of commercial space in the remote, unincorporated area. Jacob stated during the hearing, "The threat of fire is real." After Jamul residents raised concerns about the project worsening traffic congestion on Highway 94, supervisors amended the proposal to eliminate access to Highway 94, leaving thousands of residents in the proposed new homes with only one exit route, a two-lane extension of Proctor Valley Road. Those in favor of the project say it's needed to address the region's housing crisis. But with prices expected to start in the $500,000 range, the project would do nothing to fill the need of affordable housing. Proctor Valley is designated as a very high fire hazard severity zone by CAL FIRE and the California Public Utilities Commission, the highest fire risk level in California. The Proctor Valley area has burned at least 17 times in the last 100 years, and the site has burned twice in the last 15 years, including during the Harris Fire in 2007. The project site remains at serious risk for fast-moving, wind-driven fires. The suit contends, according to fire experts, a fire ignited on the project site under Santa Ana winds would likely spread southwest towards population centers at a rate of several miles per hour. That would put homes in Chula Vista at risk, less than 2 miles away. Steep terrain surrounding the project site, covered in chaparral and coastal scrub, would make fire suppression difficult. Thousands of people trying to evacuate on a single two-lane road could result in some becoming trapped, as occurred in the tragic Paradise Fire where 82 people died. Richard Housley of the Chaparral Institute says, "History has shown that during a wind-driven wildfire, developments like this one in a known fire corridor can and have been destroyed by embers flying a mile or more ahead of the flame front." He adds, "The claim that a development like this is fire-safe ignores everything we have learned during the destructive 2017 and 2018 firestorms." Sierra Club San Diego chair Peter Anderson says Otay Ranch Village 14 clearly violates a recent court decision that requires in-county mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions. The environmentalists contend that the development would eliminate crucial habitat for the endangered Kino checkerspot butterfly, as well as San Diego fairy shrimp, the California gnatcatcher, and some of the county's last golden eagles, which forage at the site. The lawsuits argue that the project is inconsistent with the county's general plan, and that the project's environmental impact report repeatedly violates the California Environmental Quality Act. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. County Supervisors' approval of the Hoskins Ranch housing subdivision near Julian has been found to violate state law, the 4th District Court of Appeals has ruled. The appellate court overturned a Superior Court ruling in the case, which was filed by Cleveland National Forest Foundation against San Diego County. The appellate court ruled that county supervisors violated the Williamson Act, since the land is protected as agricultural under state law. The project approval also violated the Subdivision Map Act, which restricts residential development on Williamson Act lands if it's not related to agriculture. The Williamson Act gives property owners huge property tax breaks of 25% to 70% if they agree to keep their land agricultural for at least 10 years. A landowner can withdraw land from Williamson Act protections, but must either pay a fee or gradually have their taxes increase over a decade before the land can be developed. But the owner of Hoskins Ranch did neither. Genesee Properties wanted to keep pocketing subsidies while also developing its 1,400 acres of pristine wilderness land less than a mile from downtown Julian. Genesee is owned by billionaire Lyndon Blue, who is also co-owner of General Atomic, a defense contractor and maker of the Predator drones. As community opposition mounted over what appeared to be preferential treatment of a billionaire developer, Genesee's lawyer sent a threatening letter to Julian's community planners, warning that if they reconsidered their earlier approval of the project, they could be sued individually. The county also received warning letters from the state's Department of Conservation, warning that approval of the project would violate state law. Genesee brought in cattle to graze on a part of the property alongside its planned future housing development, but the state again warned that this was not sufficient and that building a subdivision would be illegal. But ultimately, supervisors ignored those warnings and granted approval after more than a dozen years of wrangling over the proposed project. County supervisors must now vacate their approval of the tentative map for the proposed Hoskins Ranch subdivision, which will prevent the project from moving forward. Asked to comment on the decision and whether the county plans to file an appeal, county spokesperson Jessica Northrup said the county does not comment on pending litigation. The appellate court's published decision sets a precedent, meaning that its findings may be cited in future court cases with similar facts. Attorney Gabriel Ross, who represented Cleveland National Forest Foundation in the case, says this decision sends a signal to jurisdictions throughout California that they must comply with state laws designed to keep agricultural land in agricultural use. Cleveland National Forest Foundation Director Duncan McFetridge says the Williamson Act covers hundreds of thousands of acres of farm and open space land in California. In recent years, Cleveland National Forest Foundation, the Sierra Club, Save Our Forests and Ranchlands, and other environmental groups have won multiple lawsuits against San Diego County government over other actions, including transportation and climate change plans that contributed to sprawling developments or greenhouse gas emissions found to be in violation of state law. This latest decision to protect agricultural lands from development is yet another victory for preservationists. McFetridge praised the appellate court's ruling. "This decision is an important victory in the long effort to protect San Diego County's agricultural land and open space from sprawling development," the environmental leader says, adding, "Over the years, the county has repeatedly sided with developers to promote growth in our fragile forests and ranchlands. This decision is a clear rebuke to the county's approach."
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Goetz with the Crime Beat Report. The wife of Lemon Grove Councilman David Arambula was assaulted early Saturday morning, July 27th, while taking out trash in front of her home on Skyline Drive. Councilman Arambula posted on Facebook that his wife, Alma, was hit on the head with a wooden block around 5:30 a.m. by a stranger who opened the gate. Fortunately, she managed to escape into the home and was not seriously injured. Alma Arambula told a sheriff's deputy that her attacker was a black man, about 30 years old, and 5'9" tall, who weighs about 175 pounds. He was wearing a white shirt, dark denim shorts, high socks and white shoes, along with sunglasses and a blue hat. The sheriff's department indicates that this is an isolated incident and no similar attacks have been reported in the area. Councilman Arambula has asked for community help to find the man who attacked his wife. "Actually, I'm begging," he wrote on Facebook. "Crime Stoppers is offering a reward of up to $1,000 for information that leads to a felony arrest in this case. You can call Crime Stoppers Anonymous tip line at 888-580-8477 or call the Sheriff's Department at 858-565-5200.
This is John Fisteer. Superior Court Judge David Gill has ruled that Alvin Ray Quarles, dubbed the Bolder Than Most Rapist, will be released in San Diego County. Judge Gill has said that he believes a supervised setting will have adequate safeguards to protect public safety. But some of his victims disagree, and so does Supervisor Dan Jacob. Quarles pleaded guilty in 1989 to over a dozen sexual assaults and gained notoriety for attacking women at knife point, sometimes forcing their husbands or boyfriends to watch. He was sentenced to 50 years in prison. But in 2014, he was transferred to Coalinga State Hospital and received sex offender treatment. In 2016, he petitioned the court through a conditional release program. Last fall, Judge Gill ruled that Quarles could be released to a supervised residence in Hacumba Hot Springs. But after an outpouring of objection from residents, the judge agreed to reconsider his decision at the request of prosecutors and supervisor Diane Jacob. Victims of Quarles were banned from attending or speaking during the several days of hearings. The judge affirmed his earlier decision to release Quarles into a supervised setting, but since the earlier residence in Hocomba fell through, an August 30 status conference has been set, when the state can present housing options and the public will be allowed to testify. Cynthia Medina and Mary Taylor are two of Quarles' victims. Both criticized the closure of the recent hearings for privacy reasons to prevent disclosure of psychiatric reports on Quarles. Taylor, an East County teacher assaulted by Quarles, calls the action just one more kick in the gut, the Union Tribune reports. Taylor asked why she should trust the system after she was prevented from knowing who testified in support of Quarles' release. Supervisor Diane Jacob says the exclusion of victims is not fair and not right. She is opposed to Quarles' release. If Judge Gill believes he is fit to be placed in a community action, Jacob says, quote, I think we ought to put him right next to Judge Gill's house.
A jury in a civil trial has ruled that an El Cajon police officer was justified in shooting and killing Alfred Olango on September 27, 2016. Olango's sister, Lucy, had called 911 to ask for help for her brother, who was reportedly suffering a mental health crisis and walking into traffic. While another officer pointed a taser at Olango, Officer Richard Gonzalez asked Olango to remove his hands from his pocket repeatedly. Olango pulled out a silver and black vape smoking device that resembled a gun and pointed it at the officer, assuming a shooter's stance at point-blank range. Officer Gonzalez fired 4 shots, killing Olango, a Ugandan immigrant, as newly released video by the El Cajon Police Department shows. Gonzalez has stated that he believed the device Olango pointed was a gun and that he fired in self-protection. Police have indicated Gonzalez was also concerned that if Olango fired shots, they could strike people at a drive-through taco shop or in the parking lot nearby, both within the line of fire. The San Diego District Attorney at the time, Bonnie Dumanis, found the shooting legally justified back in 2017. The killing of Olango, an African-American, by a white police officer led to days of marches, protests, and rallies in El Cajon, heightening racial tensions. The demonstrations forced closure of Parkway Plaza shopping mall and public events in the downtown district. Lucy Olango has criticized police for escalating the situation into what she called a deadly confrontation. A psychiatric emergency response team, or PERT team, was not available at the time due to being dispatched on another call. Activists have called for reforms, including more PERT teams for the region and de-escalation training for police officers. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. This is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. My very special guest today is Corey Briggs. He has a 2-decades-long record as an attorney challenging insider power brokers who've dominated City Hall for decades. He's been described by Times of San Diego as the bane of downtown developers, and he's filed numerous lawsuits, many of them successfully championing taxpayers, voters' rights, the environment, and government transparency. He's also taught law, including courses in professional ethics, and now he's running for San Diego City Attorney against the incumbent Mara Elliott, promising to be a taxpayer's advocate if elected. And full disclosure, listeners, he also once wrote a letter on behalf of East County Magazine, our media outlet, to get a local school district, Cajon Valley, to stop violating California's open government law and cease threatening to arrest our reporters for recording public meetings. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a successful law practice. What made you decide to jump into politics and run for city attorney?
Yeah, a lot of people are asking me this question. It's a good question. Look, I've been fighting City Hall for almost 2 decades, as you said, and running for office was never on my bucket list. But I see the consequences of not having good professional legal advice given to the client, in this case, the city. And I've been watching it administration after administration. And the city faces big issues. But if you read the news, you see that frequently the city ends up in court, and it usually ends up on the wrong side of the cases. And this costs taxpayers a lot of money. It costs the city progress. And it's time for the mayor and the city council to have a lawyer who's giving them sound legal advice without the lawyer's political agenda being what drives the advice.
Could you give us an example or two of a couple of those cases where
Sure.
they were on the wrong side, where you would have advised them differently?
Yeah, sure. So probably the example that comes to mind easiest is the 2 lawsuits over SDSU West and Soccer City.
Yeah.
Right? The city attorney was opposed to these measures from the very beginning. She wrote memos that were critical of those proposals. These were put on the ballot by the voters. The city council and the mayor all said they're going to the ballot. And the city attorney's office pushed hard in secret to get permission to file lawsuits. The lawsuits were frivolous. The lawsuits were thrown out. The lawsuits cost the taxpayers about $600,000. One of my clients had me intervene on behalf of the voters to make sure that the voters would have their say on these items. The city attorney's office fought it. This makes no sense. The public spoke. The public wanted a say. The politicians had years to do something without going to the ballot, and they couldn't get their act together.
Yeah, true.
And so when the voters finally said enough is enough, we want to vote on these two proposals, the city attorney used taxpayer money to try to disenfranchise San Diego voters. That's not acceptable, and it's all driven by politics because she was opposed to these from the beginning. She was humiliated in court when the cases were thrown out. She's got something to prove. And the latest example on this was just in Voice of San Diego today about how there's a non-disclosure agreement over the negotiations on SDSU, between SDSU and the city. And the voters have already voted on it. We know what this is supposed to look like. So why are we doing this in secret?
Yeah, it seems very troubling. And speaking of secrecy, can you also address what you have characterized as her efforts to gut the California Public Records Act and how your approach to that would differ?
Sure. So earlier this year, the city attorney's office proposed changes to the California Public Records Act. You know this. I will tell it for the benefit of your listeners. Mm-hmm. That's the law that allows any member of the public to go see public information.
Right.
So the Brown Act is the law that requires meetings to be done in open. The Public Records Act is the law that lets you see the documents, the emails, the text messages, things like that. And city attorney's office proposed a change that was presented as one thing to make it easier to get documents, when in fact, the real purpose of the law was to make it nearly impossible for citizens to hire lawyers to go to court to enforce these rules. And the members of the legislature who carried this proposed legislation, they were not told the true nature of the changes. And all of this is being spearheaded by a chief of staff for the city attorney who is not a lawyer. He's the number two in the office. He's not a lawyer. He's learned more about the law from traffic school than law school. And the impetus for all of this was a very humiliating defeat that the city had a couple years back in court, where it would represent to the judge that the city had turned over all the documents. And on multiple occasions, after saying there's nothing else, the city would do another search and find out that there are more documents, sometimes hundreds more documents.
Yeah, I mean, as a journalist, I think if you ask just about any journalist in town, they would say, if anything, the Public Records Act is not strong enough because there's not any teeth in it. There is no compensation, no reimbursement for journalism organizations that file a suit to get reimbursed staff time that we have to put in. You can get attorney fees if you win, and that's it.
That's right.
So a lot of agencies, in my experience, just sort of flaunt it because they really don't think that the media is going to take them to court, let alone a member of the public who doesn't have deep pockets to go hire an attorney to begin with.
Yeah, no, that's right. The only way the Public Records Act is enforced is when you have people asking who have the means of hiring an attorney, and when they win their case, they get reimbursed for their attorney's fees. None of their other time is covered. Meanwhile, when the cities are stonewalling, all of their staff is being paid the entire time that they're blowing off the public and resisting turning over any information. So it's completely unfair to start with, and yet her approach was to make it even more unfair by making it impossible for you to get a lawyer. And worse than that, I mean, that's a horrible change in and of itself.
Yeah.
But worse than that is misrepresenting the nature of what she was doing to the legislature, not telling them that she was making this huge change. And she did it all on her own without going and talking to the mayor and the city council.
So they didn't know about that either.
Yeah, that's right. I was at the hearing when they shot her down. They were learning about it for the first time.
That's shocking. Another troubling aspect has been brought out in some recent news articles suggesting that she tried to bury allegations of child abuse involving people at the San Diego Junior Theater. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so full disclosure, I represent the father who blew the whistle on this. He tried to get information from the city to find out what they were doing to make sure that the issue was fully investigated and to make sure this never happens again. As is often the case, the city stonewalled, didn't turn much over. I got involved to get him documents. What we learned in the course of getting documents is that Mara Elliott, when she received the complaint about child abuse allegations, instead of investigating it, she sent it to one of her campaign donors, a lawyer for the Junior Theater, and said, I haven't read this yet, but I recognize the person's name. So as the city's top law enforcement officer, even before finding out what was being alleged, she's leaking it to the lawyer for the subject of the investigation.
Yeah, and a donor. You don't do that. You're not supposed to tip off someone who might be under investigation.
Totally unheard
of. Or friends with someone who's under investigation.
Totally unheard of. It's beyond unprofessional. It's beyond unethical. But it is symptomatic of the way the office has been run for far too long.
Now, it wouldn't be fair for us to talk about all of her controversies, Corey, and for me not to ask you about your own legal career, where you've at times sparked some controversy yourself. Notably, a few years ago, iNews source ran some articles suggesting, among other things, that liens you filed on properties might have been efforts to fraudulently shield assets, and they criticized you for filing suits on behalf of some nonprofits that your family or close associates reportedly controlled. Could you please address those concerns for our listeners? And also, for the record, let us know, did you ever face any sanctions from the Bar Association or any court action for any of those allegations?
Yeah, sure. Good questions. So the issue with the liens, I'm a small law firm. Right. I'm the lawyer, a couple others who work with me. My clients aren't big corporations. When you work for a big firm, and your clients are big corporations, they have lots of money, they give you a big fat retainer, and you do work. My clients don't have that sort of money available. So in some situations, when their case is going to be expensive, they will give our firm liens against property they own. Mm-hmm. There's a procedure we have to go through to disclose potential conflicts to them. They have to run it by an independent lawyer that they choose. Other than me making disclosures, they go decide whether they want to do this with the other lawyer. We have to go through that process anytime it happens. It's the only way these folks can afford to hire a lawyer.
So basically you're saying there were liens, but there was nothing illegal about the process.
Not only is it not illegal, the rules for lawyers have provisions that explicitly contemplate this sort of arrangement. As long as you follow the rules, it's perfectly fine.
Okay.
You asked another question about the organizations. I've represented lots of nonprofits. Mm-hmm. The same way that developers form entities when they build houses and then they, you know, don't want you to pierce the corporate veil, the law allows citizens to form nonprofits when they're working for the public good in order to protect their personal assets. It's totally legal. Lots of us know nonprofits all the time. That's the way it's done.
I run a nonprofit myself, and yes, we have a board, and we have that
terrorism
emissions insurance, so
that's
the board's protected.
And you do all that stuff. And yes, I help my clients establish those. There's nothing wrong with it. Those reports by that organization, I've encouraged people to follow the money, because you can see that when they were writing those stories about me, their revenues increased by more than 100% in the year they were writing the stories about me. They started booking donations on their financials in excess of $400,000. And if you go look at the list of donors, they are wealthy individuals with business downtown where my clients were suing over the project. So I'd encourage anybody to just go follow the money.
So they might have had their own conflicts of interest, arguably.
No question in my mind that they did. The last question you asked is about the state bar. The answer is yes. As a result of those reports, there were two inquiries. I received a clean bill of health from the state bar in both of those instances. It's unfortunate that the source of the false reports that prompted those bar inquiries never reported that I was cleared. They know about it. They've not reported it. I appreciate you asking so I can set the record straight.
On a more positive note, Corey, can we talk about some of your successes as a public interest attorney? What are some of the most significant cases that you've won on behalf of taxpayers, voters, and the environment locally?
Sure. So in no particular order, I had a client who sued because the city was raising taxes to expand the convention center, without a public vote. In California, new taxes require a public vote. There will be a public vote next year to raise taxes for the convention center. You can thank my client for fighting that lawsuit along with a now deceased watchdog named Mel Shapiro. Mm-hmm. Those two fought the lawsuits. We won that in the Court of Appeal. Other cases, we had a case against Walmart for essentially buying an election against a city. The voters put the proposal on the ballot. The city wasn't sure they wanted to do a special election because they're expensive. Walmart walked in with a check on the spot, wrote it to the city council and to the mayor, and they said, okay, no problem. Now we'll put it on the ballot. That was a violation of the Brown Act because the public wasn't told it was going to happen. We sued over that, and the Court of Appeals concluded that if you violate the Brown Act, even if it's for the purpose of holding an election, the violation will invalidate the results of the election. That's how important the Brown Act is.
Yeah, very, very interesting. On an environmental front, what are some of the big cases you've handled there?
So one of my earliest cases was on behalf of San Diego Coastkeeper. At the time, it was Baykeeper. Mm-hmm. A number of Marines were having to train in raw sewage up at Camp Pendleton. We sued to get the base to change that around. That was an important case. The men and women who were risking their lives ought not to have to be training in raw sewage.
Yeah.
I spent many, many years suing Walmart over their new stores to make sure that they were 100% green, which means solar, minimizing greenhouse gases, energy efficiency, things like that. There's a long list of those.
Yeah.
And then I've represented a number of community groups against, you know, harmful development where the city wasn't following the rules. Latest example is when the mayor and the city attorney tried to force a transitional housing program in the South Bay on those residents. Transitional housing is important. That's not the issue. But in the South Bay, they only have this one motel left. And this was where all the visitors stayed.
Ah.
So it's sort of a centerpiece of their economic development and their tourist-serving area. And they said that the Coastal Act didn't apply. We sued. The judge said, of course the Coastal Act applies. That's an example of trying to protect neighborhoods from overreach at City Hall.
Corey, are there any other issues that you would like to discuss, things you would like to accomplish if you're elected to city attorney?
Yeah, look, my goal in running is to get the politics out of the office. Right? Every client is entitled to objective, sound legal advice without the attorney trying to do what's in his or her best interests. The client comes first.
Mm-hmm.
And for too long, the city attorney's office has not put the clients first. City attorney's office will give advice confidentially, then tell the clients, you can't talk about it, you can't tell anybody what I told you. And that's just false. If the client wants to go say, this is what the attorney told us, the client should be free to do that. Our city attorneys hide behind confidentiality in order to push their agenda. When the next mayor and the next city council are seated, they need to know that there's somebody who understands municipal law, who is concerned first and foremost about the mayor and the council being successful on behalf of their constituents. I don't have any desire to seek other office. As I said at the beginning, I didn't have a desire to seek this one. But we're not making progress on huge issues, housing, homeless, environment, energy efficiency, transportation. All of these things are huge problems. We have huge deficits. Things just keep getting worse, and it's very often because the mayor and the city council are getting political advice masquerading as legal advice as opposed to just straight up legal advice.
Yeah, and running up big bills for taxpayers, defending in all these lawsuits that they're losing.
That's right.
So instead of spending it on some of the different things you've mentioned that maybe taxpayers would like their money spent
on. Yeah, right. I'm not out soliciting endorsements from people who are suing the city. In fact, I've said anybody who wants to donate to my campaign, you have to certify that you're not a lobbyist. If you go to my website to donate, you have to check the box that says, I'm not a lobbyist in the city of San Diego.
Wow, very good. That sounds very positive, Corey. For the record, we should mention that both you and your opponent, Mara Elliott, the incumbent, are registered Democrats. So far, no Republican has come forward that I'm aware of to announce they're running, but we certainly will. When the filing deadline, you know, comes around, we will be inviting anybody else who's on the ballot to come on the show and provide equal time listeners so that you can hear from everybody in the race.
Yeah. You should also make sure your listeners understand it is a nonpartisan race.
Correct.
And the advice that the city attorney gives should be nonpartisan. That's why I'm running.
Very good point. I understand that you actually have been a no party preference in the past. You've, like many people. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking today with Corey Briggs, a prominent local attorney with a long track record of championing taxpayers, voter rights, the environment, and government transparency. And now he's a candidate running for the San Diego City Attorney's Office. Corey, I'm going to let you have the last word today. Can you let people know where they can learn more about your candidacy and if there's anything else that you would like our listeners to know?
You bet. You can go to www.coreybriggs.com, C-O-R-Y. There's no E. Go to the website. You can see what we stand for, what we're trying to accomplish in this election. If you have questions, there's a link there where you can contact me. People have been emailing and asking questions. They want to know about things going on in the city. As long as it's not privilege for one of my active clients, I'm happy to tell people anything I can.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This week's Destination East County features Hot August Nights events, including Julian's Natural Wonder Fest, the Ramona Country Fair, the Julian Star Fest, the Heart of Mount Helix Art and Wine Festival, a Twilight Walk at Mission Trails Regional Park, and the Barona Powwow.
There are also some all-summer-long events, including outdoor concerts, movies in parks across our region, classic car shows, and dive-in movies.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Julian Natural Wonder Fest is an event to celebrate nature by day and night. This event will be held on Saturday from 4 to 11 p.m. at Jess Martin Park in Julian. A free shuttle will be offered from the heart of historic Julian to the park for this event for all ages. Activities will include wildlife encounters, music, art, and a star party to view the Milky Way. For more information, you can visit naturalwonderfest.com.
The Ramona Country Fair takes place August 1st through 4th at the Ramona Outdoor Community Center. Fairgoers can explore the Gateway to Adventure, which features outdoor adventure zones, rock climbing, amusement rides, contests, animals, attractions, vendors, western shows, medieval demonstrations, a wine festival, and more. The Ramona Country Fair is presented by the Ramona Chamber of Commerce. For more information, you can visit ramonachamber.com.
The Julian Star Fest will be held August 1st through the 4th at Mangini Winery in Julian. On Saturday night, August 3rd, members of the San Diego Astronomy Association will have telescopes set up for viewing from dusk to 10:30 p.m. For more information, visit julianstarfest.com.
The legendary 60s British rock band Herman's Hermits, with its original lead singer Peter Noon, will be live in concert at Saquon on August 3rd, with shows at 5 p.m. and again at 8 p.m. They stormed the American pop charts 22 times with smash hits such as Can't You Hear My Heartbeat, There's a Kind of Hush, and I'm Henry VIII, I Am. The boys from Manchester ultimately sold over 80 million records, including 7 gold albums, inspiring fans around the world. Tickets to the concert are available at sequan.com/events. And Sequan is spelled S-Y-C-U-A-N.
You're invited to Party for a Purpose at the Heart of Mount Helix Wine, Food, and Art Festival to benefit the Mount Helix Park Foundation on August 10th from 5 to 10 p.m. Against the backdrop of the setting sun at the historic Mount Helix Park and Amphitheater, known for its 360-degree views, guests will enjoy samples from local restaurants and wineries, plus signature cocktails, as well as live music, musical vignettes, a raffle and silent auction, and dancing under the stars to the Good Mojo Band. For tickets, visit MountHelixPark.org with Mount spelled M-T.
You're invited to join trail guides at Mission Trails Regional Park in a twilight walk on August 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. You'll learn about changes that occur at dusk as the sun goes down. Bring a flashlight and an extra layer of clothes, since it often cools down after the sun goes down. For more information, you can visit Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org.
The 49th Annual Barona Powwow takes place Friday, August 30th through Sunday, September 1st at the Barona Sports Complex on the Barona Indian Reservation. The public is welcome to come and watch native dancers and drummers from across the nation compete at the powwow, where you can also find craft vendors and food such as tacos made with Native American fry bread. For details, visit barona-nsn.gov.
Now for some all-summer-long events.
The Salvation Army Joan Crock Community Center, just one block west of La Mesa, invites you to a series of dive-in movies that you can watch in the swimming pool. The last movie of the summer is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, on August 7th at 7 p.m.
El Cajon's popular movies in the park run all summer long at parks across the city. Guests can enjoy additional fun activities before the start of each movie at nightfall. For a full list of shows all summer long, you can visit elcajonrec.org.
Lemon Grove Summer Concert Series continues through August 22nd, each Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Berry Street Park. Check the City of Lemon Grove's website calendar for a full schedule.
El Cajon's Dinner and a Concert Series is held every Friday night at Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon from 6 to 8 p.m. Shows will continue all summer long. You can bring a picnic dinner or dine early at one of the many restaurants nearby before rocking out at the outdoor concert. For full details and a schedule, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
Santee's Summer Concert Series is being held from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East on Thursday nights all summer long through August 22nd. The City of Santee has the full lineup of artists on its website.
The City of La Mesa's Sundays at 6 concert series continues at Harry Griffith Park in the Outdoor Amphitheater on Sunday evenings at 6 p.m., and the last one of the season will be on July 28th. Find more information on the City of La Mesa's website.
The La Mesa Village Association rolls out its La Mesa Classic Car Show each Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. through August 29th. This event features pre-1974 cars, trucks, and vans. The event will feature DJs and live bands located at 3rd and La Mesa Boulevard and an award giveaway at each event honoring the night's best cars. Find full details at LaMesaVillageAssociation.org.
El Cajon's Classic Cruise Nights is celebrating its centennial season. You can view classic cars every Wednesday from 5 to 8 p.m. along Main Street in the heart of downtown El Cajon. For their full schedule of events, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or our Destination East County show here on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back soon with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
The La Mesa City Council voted 3-2 last week to keep a farmer's market downtown, but starting in August it will no longer be run by the La Mesa Village Association. Instead, Brian's Farmer's Market, which has managed the market for the Merchants Group, will now be operating the market on its own. The market has been in La Mesa for over 25 years, first on Allison Avenue, then in the Civic Center parking lot, and starting early last year on La Mesa Boulevard in the heart of the downtown village. A survey found that 73% of patrons and businesses that responded want to keep the market downtown, but some businesses oppose the downtown market, including several restaurants reporting a loss of sales on Fridays, when the market is held from 3 to 7 p.m. So the city put the market out for competitive bids and received four responses. One, by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce, was withdrawn when the chamber learned that Grossmont Center had also put in a bid. But the council rejected Grossmont's proposal to hold the market at the shopping mall on Fridays, in addition to a Wednesday afternoon's farmers market that Grossmont recently launched. Grossmont offered to donate all proceeds to local charities, but the council opted to respect the wishes of the majority who voiced views at the meeting calling for the market to be kept downtown. There will be a few changes. Brian Beavers, owner of Brian's Farmers Markets, proposed cutting the number of hot food vendors in half to lessen competition with restaurants and to postpone street closure until 1:30 p.m. instead of 1 p.m. to avoid impacting the lunch crowd. Councilman Colin Parent held a press conference before the council meeting, along with Beavers, to announce his support for keeping the market downtown. That led some La Mesa residents to complain of bias, and an attorney from Calaware advised that citizens could ask that Parent recuse himself from voting. But Parent says he was not supporting a specific applicant, since two applicants' proposals offered to keep the market downtown. It was clear, however, that Parent had made up his mind against the Grossmont proposal before public testimony was presented. Parent was not the only council member accused of having a conflict of interest. One member of the public testified to ask that council member Christine Alessio recuse herself due to her relationship with a store owner who opposes the market's current location. City Attorney Glenn Sabine determined that neither Parent nor Alessio had a conflict that would require their recusal. The council hearing drew an overflow crowd, with nearly all speakers favoring keeping the downtown location and the Friday date. Operators of the market indicated changing the date would mean loss of many vendors who go to other markets on different days. Mayor Mark Arapostathis said he goes to the market every week and loves seeing the community engaging with each other in real time. Councilman Parent said he received 300 emails on the issue, most in support of keeping the market as is. Councilman Bill Baber lamented the lack of compromise and said some business owners told him they oppose the market, but are afraid to speak publicly for fear of retaliation and loss of business. Alessio confirmed this as well. Baber proposed moving the market to Sunday, drawing jeers from some in the crowd. Councilmember Akilah Weber proved to be the swing vote, drawing applause when she announced her support for keeping the market downtown on Fridays. The council voted 3-2 to move forward with a one-year contract for the management of the market under Beaver's solo application. The motion was made by Parent and seconded by Weber, with the mayor joining them to pass the motion. The council has since drawn criticism from members of the La Mesa Village Association who have voiced concerns that losing operation of the farmers market means they will have less revenues to fund future community events, such as La Mesa's popular annual Oktoberfest and Holiday in the Village. Looking for new ideas to draw people into the village and help all downtown businesses attract new customers, as well as benefiting the community, the La Mesa City Council has agreed to have staff prepare proposals to use parking meter revenues to fund new downtown events in the future. But even that has proved controversial, since council has in the past promised to save up parking meter revenues to build a parking garage downtown. Since the farmers market debate ran the meeting later than usual, a discussion on a feasibility report for La Mesa to consider launching a community choice energy program was postponed until the next city council meeting. Reporting in La Mesa for East County Magazine, this is Gerald Stevenson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
Six San Diego County parks will be closed in August, a safety measure taken each year because of the month's typically high temperatures. The closure also provides parks and recreation staff an opportunity to conduct maintenance such as trail restoration. El Capitan Preserve in Lakeside, Hell Hole Canyon Preserve in Valley Center, Mount Gower Preserve near Ramona, and Wilderness Gardens in Pala will close August 1st through August 31st. Agua Caliente Regional Park in Anza Borrego and Vallecito County Park in the desert are closed all summer and will reopen Labor Day weekend. Fortunately, there are more than 100 other county parks and preserves to explore during August. For instance, visitors can stay overnight in new cabins at Dos Picos County Park in Ramona, visit a butterfly garden at Lindo Lake County Park in Lakeside, or enjoy summer movies in the park in the evening at several county parks. You can find these parks and more at sdparks.org, sdparks.org. Cleveland National Forest, a federal wilderness area, has had many rescues on its trails leading to Cedar Creek Falls and Three Sisters Falls due to heat exhaustion. The sheriff's search and rescue team recently had to airlift out a family of five. Steep trails are also dangerous for dogs in hot weather. Several dogs have died in the Cowles Mountain Trail in Mission Trails Regional Park, for example. If you go out for a hike on any trails in San Diego's backcountry, follow these safety tips. Let someone know where you will be and when you plan to return. Hike with others, never alone. Leave your dog at home for difficult hikes, since even short hikes may be too much for your dog when the air or ground are too hot. Take plenty of water to stay hydrated. Rangers recommend about 1 quart per person for every 2 to 3 miles. Also bring ample food. Wear sunscreen, a hat, and sunglasses, and bring sunscreen to reapply. Take breaks in shade if possible. Take a fully charged mobile phone, GPS, and a map. Wear lightweight, light-colored, ventilated clothing, and bring a jacket if you plan to stay out after dusk. Be sure to wear sturdy shoes with traction for slippery rocks. Follow all posted safety rules. Also bring a flashlight, first aid kit, multi-purpose tool, and a whistle to signal rescuers in case you become lost or injured. And finally, know your limitations. Choose trails that match your level of physical fitness to maximize your enjoyment and minimize risk. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gerald Stevenson.
San Diego County Parks and Recreation has opened 4 new cabins that are accessible to people with mobility challenges. The new cabins are at Dos Picos County Park in Ramona, making it easier for nature lovers of all abilities to stay overnight. The 380-square-foot cabins are equipped with 4 beds, a table with 4 chairs, and a bathroom with a roll-in shower to accommodate a wheelchair. Outside is an accessible fire ring, picnic table, and parking spot. Plus, there is a lighted accessible walkway from each cabin to a wash station where guests can wash dishes. The new cabins were made possible in part due to a donation from Cabins by the Lake. The additions are the latest step by the county to provide services following Americans with Disabilities Act guidelines, including the removal of architectural barriers in county buildings and parks. Earlier this year, parks also opened an ADA-accessible gazebo and walkway for weddings. Reporting for East County Magazine in Ramona, this is Brianna Gomez.
County supervisors have voted unanimously to share a Black Hawk helitanker lease with San Diego Gas and Electric, giving a boost to the region's aerial firefighting options during peak fire season through June of next year. During red flag weather events, when the fire risk is greatest, the helicopter will be pre-positioned in North County. Under the agreement, SDG&E will cover the costs to operate the helitanker for the first 2 hours of any new flight, and the county will cover the second 2 flight hours. If used during a fire, the county could pay a maximum of $150,000, depending on flight time and reimbursements from the state or the federal government. The county also shares a lease with SDG&E for an Ericsson Skycrane helicopter, which was put into action for several fires last year, including the West Fire in Alpine, the Rangeland Fire in Ramona, and the Recycle Fire in Campo. The region also currently has 10 aircraft available for initial attack, including 3 CAL FIRE planes, 3 County Sheriff helicopters, 2 helicopters owned by the City of San Diego, the San Diego leased Skycrane helicopter, and a U.S. Forest Service firefighting helicopter during fire season. The county also has 3 aircraft that can be called into action as a part of a call-when-needed program. And for an extended attack during a major firestorm, the county can also request 26 military aircraft, subject to availability. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
Imagine coming across a talking meerkat huddled between tall blades of grass in the savannas of Kenya and feeling as though it is a perfectly normal encounter. That was the goal for Disney filmmakers behind this summer's live-action The Lion King remake. Filmmakers, including San Diego State University alumnus Tom Peetzman, set out to create a virtual world for real actors and computer-generated animals, in the process fashioning a new way to produce live-action films. No need to scout out locations and send a film crew traveling around the world or even use real lions. For this reimagined version, the set was a small back room with part of the floor taped off and cameras strategically positioned, including one on a dolly. Peetzman told a San Diego State interviewer that the filmmakers invented the process as they went along. He describes it as like making the train track as the train is already going down the track. The team first drafted a storyboard concept and then an animatic version, which is a series of storyboards and audio. Next, the art department created concept sketches of settings like Pride Rock and the Elephant Graveyard. This is where the production process takes an atypical turn. The team's virtual art department then began building the locations in a three-dimensional space. With the help of virtual headsets, the team scouted scene locations in the virtual world they once envisioned. Peetzman describes it as teleporting yourself around with the virtual controls in a game engine, inviting a character such as Simba to take a certain path, and others would virtually follow. He says that when it comes to technology, quote, this film has taken a huge leap forward. This version of The Lion King is a retelling of the same blockbuster story from 25 years ago, but the scenes have been given new life in a photorealistic world. The film brings about a certain sense of nostalgia, not only for the viewers, but for the filmmakers as well. All of us kind of grew up with this great film, and it's one of Disney's crown jewels, said Peetzman. I think that one of the things that makes this a very unique, special film is that it's such a well-told story that we're able to give back to so many generations. A graduate of SDSU's School of Theater, Television, and Film in the College of Professional Studies and Fine Arts, the 1987 alumnus says the university provided a foundation for his professional career. For students looking to explore a similar career, Peetzman encourages budding filmmakers to be open-minded. Initially, Peetzman thought he was destined to become a director, but when he landed his first job on the set of The Great Outdoors as a production assistant, he quickly realized he had a passion for producing. His advice to other aspiring filmmakers is, follow what you find is passionate for you. The movie itself is filled with sage advice, such as the words spoken by the elder lion Mufasa, played in the movie by James Earl Jones, to young Simba, the future Lion King. Mufasa advises, you must take your place in the circle of life. The new release of The Lion King, which also stars Donald Glover as Simba and Beyoncé as Nala, is now showing in local theaters. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewel, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.